Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is director and writer Wes Craven. Born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1930, Craven was raised in a strict Baptist household. He earned a master's degree in writing, originally wanting to be a novelist. While teaching, he bought a 16mm camera and started making short films. Desperately needing work to support his family, Craven found his way into sound editing for industrial films, where he showed an aptitude for it. After knocking around the world of indie film production, he got the chance to direct his first movie, 1972's The Last House on the Left. Assuming it wouldn't get much of a release, Craven pushed the boundaries of intensity and violence. It ended up being shown more widely than he had expected, and Craven learned that the notoriety was a two-way street. It left him ostracized in some corners of the film world because of the film's relentless and unsparing brutality. Craven tried to get out of the horror genre by writing several non-horror screenplays, but could not find any takers. Finally, under financial duress, he wrote and directed 1977's The Hills Have Eyes. That film, and its success, Craven said later, forever cemented him as a horror guy. He directed some TV movies, including 1978's terrific Summer of Fear. He then moved on to 1981's Deadly Blessing and 1982's Swamp Thing, his first PG movie. Craven had greater creative success with 1984's A Nightmare on Elm Street, introducing one of the most iconic horror figures of the last 50 years, Freddy Krueger, whom Craven based loosely on someone he knew from his real life. Now a marketable name, Craven entered a new phase of his career, often getting his name above the title. He directed original horror entries such as Shocker, The Serpent in the Rainbow, The People Under the Stairs, and then returning to the seemingly indestructible Freddy franchise, playing himself in the fourth wall breaking Wes Craven's A New Nightmare. Craven achieved his biggest box office success of his career with 1996's Scream, which became a pop culture sensation and introduced him to a new generation of horror fans. Its massive success earned him the opportunity to direct his sole non-horror movie, 1999's Music of the Heart, which earned Meryl Streep an Oscar nomination. He continued with the Scream franchise, directing Scream 2 and 3, as well as Cursed, My Soul to Take, the horror thriller Red Eye. He reteamed with Kevin Williamson to direct what would be his final film, 2011's Scream 4. Joining me to discuss Scream 4 and the career of Wes Craven is writer and podcaster Sarah Century. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Yay.
Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for agreeing to talk with me about Wes Craven.
Well, that did not take a lot of convincing. I grew up on Wes Craven's movies. I absolutely loved his stuff. I will admit at the top of the show, though, when you pitched to me Wes Craven, right? We were talking about, like, I wanted you on the show because we podcasted before. And I was like, I really want to have you on Fade Out. What do you want to talk about? And when you mentioned Wes Craven and I looked up his final film, I didn't know that there was a Scream 4. I didn't know. I had no idea this movie existed. I had seen the first three and I knew that there had been the kind of reboot, requel, sequel thing, from last year, just last year. But I was like, there's a Scream 4. I didn't even know that. So this was my first viewing of that film. I just completely, and so I didn't even realize that that was his final film, but it was enormous fun to go back into his filmography, which is crazy and varied, and watch a bunch of titles that I either A, hadn't seen in a long time or had never seen in the first place outside of Scream 4. So it was a blast revisiting his filmography because there's a lot of crazy stuff there.
It is wild. Yeah, I've been going back over the Scream franchise a lot lately because I've just always been a huge horror fan. As long back as I can remember. And I remember Scream whenever it first came out, the 1996 first film. That was the one where all of my friends were into horror now too, right? Like everybody was like, oh, this like weird thing that Sarah likes, we also think is really great, right? Like Sarah's always hanging out and watching slashers whenever we have a party instead of socializing. And, you know, then it was like, now it's normal that she does that, I guess, like in a very kind of funny way, because it really did kind of blow the doors open, right? For a lot of different horror movies to kind of, no, I wouldn't say copy the format, because you had stuff like, you know, I Know What You Did Last Summer. that's not like a ripoff of Scream by any stretch, but it's such like a similar vibe. And you see that horror got very mainstream for a bit there. And it was all these like beautiful, like people who are playing teenagers. Very seldom are they actually teenagers, right? But they're playing teenagers and there's this kind of high school vibe to it. It was at the time whenever I was a teenager, you know, these are the biggest stars in the world to me. Like Neve Campbell was huge in my life, right? And like, you know, all of this, Sarah Michelle Gellar, like all of the people who pop up in these kind of late 90s horror movies. And of course it did kind of open the door to like everything getting super gruesome after the Iraq of like the like 9/11 and everything. I think that horror kind of took a turn to being, you know, Hostel, Saw, like all of that. And then of course here comes all the remakes, right? So I think that like blockbuster horror was something that I just, it wasn't really happening. It wasn't a thing like whenever I was a kid. And Scream was kind of the thing that made everybody be watching it, because now it's like 90210 meets horror, right? Like it's, and I think that that's cool. And I don't want to be dismissive to Scream, because I think that the writing on it is so stellar. Like it's such a good movie. And I think it's a great franchise even. I just got finished watching the sixth Scream film and you know what? It's good. I just think that they're really good movies for the most part. And sometimes I have to watch them a few times before I start to love them. Like Scream 3 was one where I watched it and was like, wow, this is a terrible movie. And then I was like, you know, rewatched it pretty recently. And I was like, wow, this movie is so worth watching. Even if you just watched Parker Posey in this movie playing Gale Weathers, it's so good. But, you know, it's like, it goes off the rails at the end. We could talk about that more, but it was basically just that, right? Like, I was a teenager, Scream was huge. That's why I kind of have been revisiting it as much as I have been lately. And because it's kind of, this was the first year that there was a Scream movie that, you know, didn't center around Neve Campbell. And probably off the top, we should mention that that was because they refused to pay Neve Campbell the amount of money that she's worth. And so that sucks. That's like a worker's issue.
Oh, is that why it was? Is that why she's not in it?
Yeah. And she was very clear about that too. She was like, I would love to come back. I'm not going to come back because they're not going to pay me the way that they should. She's like, if they offered, you know, if a dude had carried a horror franchise up into like the sixth film, I feel that they would be offering him a lot more money than they're offering me. So I'm just not going to do it. So that's why she didn't come back. And I have full support for her. I just want to say that like off the very top, because I think that that sucks. Like they should have paid her for sure. That said, Scream 6 was pretty great.
Okay. Now, can you remember when you were conscious of like Wes Craven as a figure? When you saw Scream, was that a name that meant anything to you in 1996 or whenever it is you saw Scream for the first time?
It was, because I remember the way that they were selling it. Like, you know, nobody had any idea how huge Scream was going to be. So they were selling it like, this is the director of The People Under the Stairs. And like now today, nobody remembers, like comparatively, not that many people remember that, you know, as far as like the Scream franchise has gone on to have six movies. That really hasn't been the case with People Under the Stairs, right? Like that was just kind of a one and done. And I kind of understand why, you know, but like, I loved that movie. People Under the Stairs was like a movie that we watched all of the time in my house. Of course, when Scream came out, I was 13. So I'm talking like, I have always loved horror. This was like, I was a little kid watching horror movies. And I know I had seen Nightmare on Elm Street, but it wasn't until probably, you know, around the time that I was watching The People Under the Stairs that I actually had some kind of recognition of the fact that like there's a guy who makes this, and like what that means, obviously, as a kid I didn't have a great understanding of, but it was like, there's a guy who makes this, and like the person who has, you know, like headed up the project is this same guy who did this movie, this movie, and this movie. And beyond that, like, you know, the things that I am aware of now, whenever I'm like, oh, look at the nuance of the way that, you know, or something, whenever you're watching directors now and you kind of, you know more about it, I guess, you know more about filmmaking. But at the time it was just like, oh, this magical dude just created all of these horror movies that I love somehow, right? And that was basically it. I remember being just absolutely captivated by The People Under the Stairs.
Apparently they're remaking that.
What?
Yeah, it's listed on IMDb under Wes Craven's filmography as up. Of course, once someone passes away and you see in their IMDb that it says upcoming projects, you're always like, well, what? How can that be? And then it's yeah. Oh, it's something to develop, and it's because it's based on his creation, based on his character. So apparently, I mean, who knows if it's ever going to get made, but it's in the process in some form of being remade. So
it's just like, how are you gonna find the people, like literally the Twin Peaks couple that like
right.
plays the brother Everett and McGill, sister.
Yeah.
I was like, do they not just they're so scary, they're absolutely repugnant human beings and that you know, and not as people, obviously they're just actors and I'm sure that they're lovely, but like you can just even as a kid, it was like the sense of how gross these people are, like, was just so, so all over that movie, right? Like, the second you see them, you're like, wow, they're awful. And they're so awful, so delightfully awful throughout the movie in many places. I'm not going to condone every part of this movie, but that, like, I'm going to say definitely that, like, you know, slurs fly all over that film. But, yeah. You know, so not exactly the most comfortable thing to watch, but it's also just like they're never not the villain, right? Like there's never a moment where you sympathize with them even slightly. Like they're just monsters in that movie. And I'm just like, who else could do that? Those two actors just, you know, they were killing it over in Twin Peaks. And then they were like, what about this? And it's like completely wild, like performance where like, you know, I mean, even as weird as Twin Peaks is, I don't think I ever would have expected to go from Twin Peaks to The People Under the Stairs. Like that is a wild, wild performance from both of them.
there are several different pathways to take into the career of Wes Craven because I kind of want to talk about the Scream thing is its own thing within his career. And then there's, I want to talk a little bit about how he had to toggle between studio films and non-studio films and how that is perceived differently from the audience, at least, you know, for someone like me versus someone who's making the movies. But you said the word repugnant, and yeah. that is going to be the Rosetta Stone for how I'm going to start this career retrospective, because we got to go back and start with his first film, which is Last House on the Left. Now, yeah. I'm going to assume you have seen Last House on the Left, right? I don't, you know.
I sure have. Yeah. Okay. I watched it. Actually, that's a movie that I watched very young, and I do not recommend.
Well, see, that's exactly it, right? So, because I had never seen it, it was one of those ones I had just, you know, during my video store days, I just hadn't seen it. And then in the 90s, the late 90s, I had some friends who screen horror movies in theaters. They have they're their own little concern out here in New Jersey and the general area, and they screen classic horror, sci-fi, and lots of genre movies. And one night they ran Last House from the Left, and I was like, oh, I've never seen it. It's Wes Craven's first movie. Perfect. I'll get to see it in the theater, right? Perfect way to see it for the first time. Well, it's one of those movies that I think is, like, on a technical level, in terms of what Wes Craven is trying to do, he hits his mark, right? So on that end, to me, it's successful.
Yeah.
It is exactly the kind of movie he wanted to make, which means it's inherently kind of a good movie. But on the other hand, it's so repugnant that I am like, I never want to see this again. And
everyone is disgusting. Like, I
just
hate
feel like
everyone.
You want to take a shower after you've seen that movie. And so it's one of those things where I'm like, would I recommend it? I don't know, because I don't know if I want to subject other people to it. But at the same time, I can't say it's a bad film, because it's exactly what Craven set out to do.
It's one of those, oh, well, I'll never watch that again. Like, mm-hmm. That's kind of how I felt after, you know. I was so young and I have no idea. I don't know. Nobody was watching what I was watching whenever I was a kid. I'll just say that. And, you know, things would just come on because we had cable, you know, or whatever. Like we had, my dad worked at Viacom when I was very young.
Oh, wow.
A lot of my, as like Viacom. an installer, right? Like he was like a going around like you know hooking up cable for people and stuff. But it was like basically that we had free cable for like a little while, and I had insomnia as a kid, so I would always just be wandering into the living room and watching things. And of course, in the 80s, what's playing at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning on HBO? It's probably going to be a horror movie. So I just remember watching a lot of horror just so young that, you know, sometimes people will be like, oh, I don't like horror. And I'm just like, that's so interesting, because I just don't know what that means. Because I'm like, A, there's so many horror movies. There are so many horror movies. Last House on the Left is not... does not indicate horror overall. Like, it's not how every horror movie is, but there are horror movies like it. So, like, there are ones that are just like so brutal that even somebody who loves horror movies as much as I do, like, I know it and I don't need to watch it again. You know, like, I saw it. Sometimes I'll just skip movies like that. I've skipped a Serbian film. I don't need to see it.
I can go through my life without having seen that movie.
But I see why people would like them, you know, like that's kind of the thing, is like I don't have a good sense of judgment on horror, because I'm just like, I was watching stuff I definitely shouldn't have been watching as like a very young child, right? So I'm always just kind of like, yeah, it just seems pretty normal to me. Just because it's not really something I want to necessarily sit through doesn't mean that I think that it's weird for somebody to sit through it, because, you know, violence is everywhere in our lives. So I always think that horror plays such an interesting role. Like, people will sometimes be like, nah, you just want to watch people get stabbed, like, whatever. And it's like, yeah, sometimes, you know, like, sometimes I would say that Wes Craven is like the master of the artful death, right? Like, there are so many deaths in his movies that are just stunning, right? Like, a person gets a basketball thrown at their head and their head explodes. There's just like so many deaths. Like, The Scream, you know, we'll get into that soon, but it all begins with Last House on the Left, where it's just these brutal murders that you can't look away from, and it doesn't let you look away from them. And that's what I think is important, because, you know, it's kind of based on like The Virgin Spring, right? Like, by the Ingmar Bergman film. And like, The Virgin Spring is a masterpiece. It is equally violent, but it doesn't show the violence all the way. But it shows enough of it to be a highly disturbing movie. The subject matter is really upsetting. And then the ending of it is this kind of like religious message in a weird way. Whereas Wes Craven is making Last House on the Left, like in the aftermath of like the Vietnam War, where Americans were just seeing people die horrifically, like on the news all the time. You know, it's like after Manson, it's after you know, war crimes in Vietnam, and there's just like all kinds of really highly political and really disturbing things that were just in the air at that time. So I think that the way that in the 60s somebody like Bergman could make a movie like The Virgin Spring and then just be like, but God, religion, like, you know, at the end, makes it be kind of like, I'm not going to say it's a cheap ending. It's just not one that I agree with, because something really horrific has happened. And it's just kind of an interesting, serene note, I guess, to go out on. Whereas Wes Craven doesn't let you have that at all. Last House on the Left.
No.
And it's like, honestly, like, in a lot of ways, I really do think that's a good thing. Like, you know, just because I don't want to watch it again doesn't mean that I don't have the utmost respect for the need to do things like this in film, because it's like, you know, like, people so often use film as escapism. And I think that there's really something beautiful about directors who are willing to be like, not this movie.
Like, yeah, no.
Actually, we're confronting this head on, and it's going to be just as ugly as it is in real life. And you're just like, oh no. Like,
the history of movies is dotted with people who do a project going into it saying, oh, this will never be seen. So this won't be a problem. I'll make the money and it'll never be seen by anybody. And then that's the thing they become famous for.
Right.
You know, whether they're an actor, like the guy, I forget I'm blanking on his name, but like the lead actor of Plan 9 from Outer Space was like, this movie's a piece of crap, but I need the money. I'll do it. Nobody will ever see it. And it became the number one thing he's famous for is Plan 9 from Outer. He didn't plan that. And Wes Craven apparently went into this film thinking no one's going to see it, but it's my first shot. And I'm going to just go for it because it'll make my name in a way that it'll get me future jobs. And then this thing ends up tapping a little bit into the zeitgeist at the time. And yeah, it got him notoriety. But then parts of the business were like, I don't want to hire this guy. This guy must be a sadist.
Yeah.
You know, like, and it's like, no.
People were like walking away from tables that he was at and stuff. And that's just like kind of wild because I, you know, I think that there's something to be said too. And I would like to mention, because we are going to very shortly talk about some of the sex industry stuff that he did. And it's like, I also just wanted to note that, you know, he was using actors that he had worked with, I believe, on like the set of these films. And, you know, there's something kind of interesting in how people are so dismissive of porn. People are so dismissive of horror, but then there are works of art in these genres as well. So I always think that in a way it's fascinating because if he's not judged for one, he would be judged for the other kind of at that time period. I feel like even though we were going into an era where, you know, like porn had a very short period of time where it was really considered to be art for a second, like, you know,
right behind the green door. And,
those are movies that were created in a time where there it was like such a success and it was like it could only happen in that specific window of time, right? You know, not to say that there won't be like a resurgence of this at some point. It's just saying that, like, you know, we haven't seen one, right? Like, it's been basically that was like the second, you know, where porn was really famous and considered to be something that even like, you know, people of high culture or whatever should watch or would have seen, at least for the sake of conversation, right? You know, we have to have something to talk about at parties. So, you know, and I just think that, you know, there's something very interesting about that kind of crossover where he comes from this kind of background where people would be dismissive and like grossed out by him and just be like, absolutely not. I know what you've come up with. And a lot of the guys that were kind of contemporary to him, they had careers that were a little bit off after, you know, their first, you know, Toby or, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, Toby Hooper. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Toby Hooper. I was going to call him Toby Cooper. And then I was just like, that's not his name. A few other directors of that time had much rockier careers, whereas Wes Craven seems like he was really able to just tap into the zeitgeist again and again in a way that made him so relevant because of just the very specific vibe that he was able to get. Like these kind of unspoken things that we were all concerned about, I guess. Like, you know, the seedy underbelly, I guess, of like suburban life, which checks out with his background, right? Because it's like the Baptist thing is wild.
Well, it's funny. I read a book about him. It's kind of a oral history. It's called Wes Craven, A Man and His Nightmares. And it's these two authors and they're interviewing him just about his career. And he talks about that he was raised in a very strict Baptist household to the point where they weren't even allowed to see movies. Which is, again, ironic considering what that he would get into movies and B, what kind of movies he would get into.
Yeah.
But it's sort of funny because then later on, everyone who wanted to chronicle the life of Wes Craven would use that as the, oh, well, that's why he's such a freak now. And he said later, I wish I had never told people that because they just used it as shortcut to, well, that's why he's this horror maven. And it's like, no. Part of it really is that this is a guy, and we'll see this in example after example after example to his career up until basically Scream, was that he got locked into a genre and he was so good at it that every time he got hired, he would say, well, look, I can do something a little different. And the studio would say, okay, great. He would deliver that different movie and they'd say, this isn't Wes Craven-y enough. Add more violence. And so it was like this kind of, you know, terrible doom loop where it was like he was capable of doing. I mean, he had a master's in English, for Pete's sakes. He loved classical. I mean, this is a guy had a lot of interests, and yet, you know, he does something like, and we're jumping ahead a little bit, like he gets something like Deadly Friend, which he envisioned as kind of a weird sci-fi movie. And then the studio literally said, this is great, but please add 6 more kills to it. And like, well, what do you think, you know?
Like, that's who we have to thank for the exploding head with the basketball.
He's right. And then, right now, it's the most memeable. Yeah, it's the most, you know, it's that that's almost one of the biggest horror memes ever is that basketball head thing. but anyway, yeah. So Last House on the Left. It's a hit, but it doesn't really do anything for his career. And he's got a family at this point. He's got to get work. And so he ends up directing and appearing in a porn film. And now he uses a pseudonym, Abe Snake, one of the great pseudonyms anybody's ever going to use. He directs this porno film in 1975 called The Fireworks Woman. And it is, he's in it. He's wearing a top hat at one point. You see him. He is not participating in any of the porn activities, but he's a character in the movie. And I will tell everybody, I watched it. I was, for the sake of completeness, I searched out The Fireworks Woman and I watched it. And, you know, it's a porn film. I mean, there's no, you know, it straight up is a porn film mixed in with a lot of falderall about, you know, there's a lot of narration of our main character. And she's, you know, trying to explore, you know, who she is as a person. And then we cut to hardcore explicit sex. And that's what the movie is. So it's kind of amazing that for a guy who envisioned himself having a movie career, he would appear in it. You would think that would be the last thing you would do if you were just trying to just cash a check and move on to the next thing. But yeah, he's straight up in it. I'm like, that's Wes Craven in this porn film.
Yeah, it is really kind of amusing. I don't know. That one I skipped, as I mentioned before the call started, that I only just now found out about this. I had not heard about it at all, which seems wild. It feels like if anybody would know a factoid like that about Wes Craven, I would know. And I might have actually read it, because they must mention it in that Shock Value book, right? I forget who that's by, but it talks about
that's a great book. I thought they did. Yeah, I read that book a bunch of years ago, but that's a terrific book, Shock Value.
Yeah,
but yeah,
it's fun.
Yeah,
that's a fun book.
I mean, he doesn't. I mean, Craven didn't hide it. He admitted it. Like, I did. He needed the work. He had a family to feed, and he couldn't get a job. And that was something else that I wanted to mention, is that when you're, and I don't know if this is your experience, Sarah, growing up with this stuff, but I know it was mine. When I was a kid seeing movies, I made no qualitative difference in my mind between an independent film and a studio film. I just didn't know the difference. You know, they're all movies. Movies are movies. I saw it in the theater, or I watched on video cassette. Movie is a movie. There's no difference. Some are bigger budgeted. And I mean, I knew enough as a kid to be like, well, Star Wars is obviously, you know, a lot of money went into that versus some other little thing, but they're all movies. But to someone who works in film, working independently and working in a studio are two completely different animals. They are night and day. And so this is a guy who is struggling to get a job, just to literally get a job to put food on the table. And so he doesn't want to do, he writes all these screenplays. He wrote like an action adventure movie about drug cartels that he tried to sell, and it never went anywhere. And he wrote some other screenplays. No one wanted them. And so in 1977, he's like, well, horrors, I know how to do horror. And so he reteams with Sean Cunningham, who another guy from, and they do The Hills Have Eyes, and that's a hit. And like I said in the intro, that's when he knew, all right, I'm the horror guy, because that's, you know, I have two, the only two hits I have in my name are very, very memorable horror films. But this is a guy who was desperate to get like a decent payday, because he's working his ass off for these budgets of like nothing, you know? I mean, it's, we think of, when you think of someone who's a movie director, you think, oh, they must be rich, right? Because they're a movie director. No.
Right.
You know,
that is not true. Yeah.
Not true.
Some of my favorite directors are absolutely not rich.
Yeah.
I think that that's kind of the thing, is I feel that film, as much as it's not known for this, but film has always had a really strong working class foundation, right? Like there's always been creators that really did just start with this vision and were able to make it work. And obviously a lot of times that was also a product of immense privilege of different kinds, but you had these people who really didn't have money and were kind of going in and struggling to get their stuff out. And now we can be like, oh, that's some of the best movies ever. You know, like something like somebody like Chantal Ackerman, right? Like had a whole career of people just like not really giving her the props that she deserved for all of this really innovative stuff that she was doing. And it's endless. That's like an endless story. And I think that there's something very interesting about Wes Craven because, yeah, a lot of his movies are such like suburban horror, right? But it's kind of that, like it is kind of suburban horror to not be able to have a job and to live in a nice house, right? Like that's right. Like both of those things. It's like the nice house can be its own source of stress. And I think that that's something that I never really forget whenever I'm watching his movies. I don't know like what it is about his specific viewpoint that leads to that. But whenever I kind of see it, you know, everybody in Nightmare on Elm Street, like that's a nice suburban house, but there's all of these other anxieties that make it an unlivable space for, you know, not just the kids, but the adults. Like it's everybody is kind of losing it in that movie and they're all pretending that they're not, except for Nancy pretty much. And I just think that there's so much to that I don't know, not that many people nail it the way that he does, you know?
Yeah, well that's the thing is that I had known a while ago that he did TV movies as well, but I had not seen any of them to this point. So I was like, oh great, now's my excuse to check out some of his TV movies, because the next thing he does after Hills Have Eyes, which again another grimy, you know, really ugly movie. Ugly movie.
Oh,
although
yeah.
Although it's a little easier to take because it's so cartoony. You got Michael Berryman as, you know, the cannibal family and they're running around.
But it's definitely like, don't go into the woods because the hillbillies will eat you.
Yeah. Like, just, you know, good advice.
Sure.
But he does this TV movie called Summer of Fear with Linda Blair. Have you seen that one?
Oh, I haven't seen Summer of Fear. I was wanting to hear about this because that's one of the few that I actually haven't caught. And I, once again, I was like looking over his whole resume basically and was like, wait, what? Where did that come from?
So Summer of Fear is the TV movie with Linda Blair. And it is, I watch it, it's on available on YouTube. It's terrific. It's really terrific. Now, again, you think Wes Craven and TV movie, you're like, well, those two things don't go together, right? Because this is a guy that's like blood soaked and unrelenting misery and grimness. How's he going to manage to pull off anything scary on the restrictions of TV? But he kind of does. I won't get into the plot. It's basically there's a possession angle. And ironically enough, Linda Blair is not the evil person in the movie. She's actually this young daughter who has to deal with a supposed cousin who shows up, who starts using her kind of succubi powers to turn the entire family against her. And she's like the lone woman who's like, can't all the rest of you see this? Like, what's going on? And I watched it and it was so funny to me. And this is something I have to have this conversation one day with my pal, Amanda Reyes, the queen of the TV movies, who does made for TV mayhem. But like, that movie is so steeped in like satanic culture that I'm like, this aired on mainstream television in 1978, like in the middle of like Rice-A-Roni ads and you know what I mean? Like, and yet here's this thing about like a succubus at one point. I'm like, God, TV audiences were just way more tolerant of that. Like, I can't imagine such a thing nowadays airing on broadcast television.
You know, I've seen some horror made for TV horror films that are just either like they're almost just masterpieces. Like it's happened before. When a Stranger Calls, the sequel to that is When a Stranger Calls Back. That's a made for TV movie that brings back Carol Kane as someone who's suffering from long-term PTSD. And like, she is able to like channel that into helping people who have gone through similar traumas. It's a really, really good movie. And it's like wild because nobody remembers this film, but I watched it by chance as a kid and was just like, this is a goddamn masterpiece. And then you have, you know, all of these. I watched one that was called like Satan's Triangle that had Kim Novak in like the '70s. Of course, Satan's School for Girls is Satan's like School one for of Girls. My favorites.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm surprised and not surprised to hear that Wes Craven really showed up for that.
I mean, I shouldn't be because he's a talented director, but I was pleasantly shocked to see that he could restrain himself to where there's no gore, there's no, you know, but yet it's still scary. It was so funny. I put it on. It was so funny. I put it on late at night. My wife had gone to sleep and I was like, okay, well, let me watch. I'm like, oh, you know what? I got to watch some of these Wes Craven films. Let me catch up. So I'm like, oh, it's on YouTube. So I put Summer of Fear on and then she woke up like 2 minutes into it and she's like, what is this? I said, oh, it's tell her it's Summer of Fear. And then she was kind of like, all right, whatever. And she rolled her and then like, she started to watch it and then full on, we watched the whole movie together because we got hooked into it, you know, and it was like, yeah, this is really effective. Like he really did a good job with it. And again, I shouldn't be surprised. He's a talented director, but I just never would have thought that a guy so known for horror could do a TV movie. But that is, even as I'm saying that, I realize how silly that is because not too long after this, he did Swamp Thing, which I cannot honestly say is quote unquote a good movie, but I love Swamp Thing. I saw it in the theater. It's based on a comic book that I love. It has Adrienne Barbeau, one of my favorite people on the planet.
And oh, yeah.
I love Swamp Thing unreservedly. And that's PG. I mean, he's able to keep it, you know, he kept the horror to a minimum in that film. It didn't do it a lick for his career because it was kind of a flop. But I sometimes forget, like, that's a Wes Craven movie, Swamp Thing.
Yeah, I forget it too. And then it's like, there's something so interesting about the adaptations of Swamp Thing because it's never like Swamp Thing very much, but it also is in a weird way. So it's like kind of this thing where every time I see Swamp Thing in pop culture, even in that, he had his own cartoon in the '90s, right?
Swamp Thing.
It was so funny. Okay. Yeah, see, it's like, this is the thing, is once, that is not a good cartoon, I'm sure. And,
no.
But I have very, very fond memories of it. So it's like, it's good for a time.
It was definitely a thing. It was most definitely. And I will tell you that when just a couple of weeks ago, I got to meet Adrienne Barbeau at a Monstermania con. And that was all dream come true. And what did I have her sign? My VHS copy of Swamp Thing. So,
oh my God, that's amazing. That's the best part of the Swamp Thing legacy.
Oh my goodness. Now we have, I'm jumping over another film that we have to talk about because I had not seen this one
We just watched this one.
I had not seen this one up until an hour and a half before we recorded. And then Sarah mentioned it and I was like, oh geez, I forgot to see it. Deadly Blessing.
Yeah.
Ernest Borgnine and Sharon Stone. That's the only time you're going to say those two names together in a movie. This movie is bonkers.
This is wild. They kill the husband immediately. They definitely introduce him like he's going to be like the main dude in the film. And then he's dead. And
nope.
Like, boom, dead. Sharon Stone, what the hell, the star power that comes off of Sharon Stone. Sometimes I'll watch a movie, like one of the old horror movies that a famous actor did before they were famous. This is true also of Meg Ryan in the Amityville 3D.
Oh God, that's right. She's in that movie.
And she's like a celebrity. Like it's immediate. Like
some people just pop.
Yeah. And it's always wild when you see it because it's such a rare thing, you know, like a lot of times you're like, oh, this is a goofy movie. And maybe you'll like the people or like what the actors are doing or something. But yeah, watching Sharon Stone in this movie was just like, well, no shit, you became like the most famous person on the planet because you were in this. Like, this was nothing else if not a trial run for Basic Instinct, you know, like she's just like destroying it kind of. And it's in such kind of a, like, I don't know, there was more to this movie than I thought there was going to be, honestly. Like, I kept being like, this is stupid. But then I was like, this is really good, though. It can be stupid and good.
It's both those things. You keep thinking you're going to know where it's going, and then it, it zigs. It's just like, you know?
you did not know.
Like, what? You know, and there's spiders dropping in people's mouths and murder. And you, yeah, it's just a bonkers movie, you know?
Yeah.
And it was another flop. And so, you know, poor Wes Craven is just struggling. He's got these movies to his name, but he's kind of struggling to, oh, by the way, I will mention this, and it's only because it's mentioned in the Wes Craven book, so I don't feel like I'm telling gossip, but Wes Craven was married to, he was married three times, and I think it was his second wife who eventually left him. And do you want to guess who his, you're not going to guess unless you know the story already, Sarah, but I mentioned this in the book. Do you know who Wes Craven's second wife left him for?
No.
Sharon Stone.
What?
Yes. What? Apparently they were very close friends, and Wes was like, oh great, my wife has a best friend. And then it apparently was a little bit more than that.
What?
Yes.
This is my favorite story I've ever heard. This is amazing. I am absolutely stunned. That's wild, because I know that this happened. Like, I knew this story kind of, but only from the perspective of like his wife left, right? Like, it wasn't like also left for a pretty good reason, one might say.
I mean, you can't blame her, but at the same time, you're like, Wes Craven is giving young Sharon Stone a job.
Yeah.
You know? And then
and Sharon Stone's like, your wife is my wife now, actually.
Like, what? What is that? You know, what is that about? Yeah. That's in the book. I was like, holy gee. So I'm no shock they didn't work together again.
Listen, Sharon Stone, I have nothing but the utmost respect for this move. I think it's incredible. And, you know, she went on to play so many just absolutely top notch bisexual villains over time that I feel like that's a pretty fitting way to begin her
there you
career.
Go. Pretty amazing. Yeah.
And definitely blessing of all movies. Yeah, she's incredible in it. Like, it's actually surprising because you aren't quite prepared to have an incredible performance in the middle of this.
Yeah, movie. I mean, it's like no knock on the actress who stars in Deadly Blessing.
Yeah, they're all good.
She's like, good in it, but Sharon Stone is Sharon. Like, she's just, you're kind of like, why isn't the movie about her? It kind of reminds me, again, forgive me for this diversion. Have you ever seen Krull? Sci-fi movie? Right. Okay. So like the main guy who stars in Krull is kind of like wallpaper.
Yeah.
And then at one point in that movie, he runs across a brigand played by Liam Neeson. And you're like, why isn't Liam Neeson the main guy?
This is the main character. He's immediately stealing the scene.
And then when he leaves the film, you're like, wait, what happened to the big movie star guy? You know, you just can't. There's just something about sometimes people are just movie stars.
Yeah,
that's it.
And like, I mean, I will be fair that Sharon Stone just like in a sexy nighty for about the last like 30
yeah, she's
minutes
in that blue
of the
nighty
movie.
Like,
I mean, what are you doing? That's basically just like, of course we're gonna think she's the best character because she's super hot, but then like also at the very, it's like they don't give the other actor enough to do, right? Like, that's kind of the thing. Is like, she's supposed to be like the kind of like stricter, prudish one who's like off, like, I will do the things that I want to do my own way. I will mourn my husband for the rest of my life, like all of that kind of stuff, which is fine. It's totally fine to choose this life, but it also like limits her. Whereas like there's these moments where Sharon Stone like wakes up from a horrible nightmare and then she's kind of scary and you're just like, oh, this is like, you just gave her the best role on top of it. So just to add to the fact that she does a really good job, as you were saying, no knock to the other actors, she is given the best role.
I mean, nobody knows when someone's gonna be a movie star. They're like random explosions, they just happen. You can't, you know, what can you do? So he ends up doing another TV movie called Invitation to Hell with Susan Lucci, which is bonkers. Robert Urich, Joanna Cassidy, and Susan Lucci, with more satanic stuff in it, and it has an ending that has to be seen to be believed. If you ever want to see a movie where Robert Urich literally goes down into the bowels of hell, this is your movie.
See, See, this is what's upsetting me right now, is I have the list of his filmography off of Wikipedia, but it doesn't have the made-for-TV movies.
Oh, really?
Same okay. As like his film, which I think is wrong, because they should put it next to it and just put made-for-TV. So yeah. Then that way people kind of have a better idea of where it's from. But like, what is going on? It's totally not even on this list. And I'm just like, speaking as a made-for-TV horror films of the 70s, 80s, and 90s advocate, I'm just like, come on.
Yeah, it's pretty dull, and then it gets crazy, and you're just like, yeah, what?
And Susan Lucci is a force. Like, I hear she's one of those people where everybody is like, she's a diva, and like, who knows what any of that even means anymore. But it's like, I used to watch All My Children all of the time as a kid, and there was never a Susan Lucci scene where it wasn't the Susan Lucci scene, right? Like, there's other actors present. Like, good luck to them, right? Because it's Susan Lucci all the way. And you're just like, if a made-for-TV horror film directed by Wes Craven, I'm there.
Yeah, it really is crazy. So then he does Hills Have Eyes Part 2. I would admit, I have not seen that one. I don't like the first one. I just find the first one to be kind of just generally unpleasant. So the thought of seeing more of it is kind of like, yeah, right.
And it's for what I remember, it is basically just more of it. However, okay. I will note that those two movies I watched when I was like 11 or something, like on VHS. So I don't remember it. I know. I mean, call my parents, you got to put them in jail. They're
like, Dad was busy installing cable for people. He's busy. Yeah. It's stuff to do, you know?
I don't know.
He was doing the Lord's work, Sarah. We can't knock him for that.
It's true. And it's also true that I was just a very dedicated horror fan from very early on.
There you go. You were seeking it out as well. So
you know how kids are. Like, if they want to see something, it's real hard to keep it from them. And I was definitely just like, good thing I have insomnia. I'm going to go watch a horror movie in the living room while everybody is sleeping. They'll never know.
The minute I got my first video store rental card, I was in the horror section nonstop.
Every nonstop. Day. I lived in, after, you know, I was a kid, I was born in Nashville, but then I lived in a rural town in Missouri, and it was like, VHS every day. And what did they stock? Movies from like 1985 on, and then a massive horror section. Yep. So it was like, you just watched every bad horror movie that came out, because there were so many of them. And it was, you know, you would get like two other good movies that month, you know, maybe like six tops. You'd probably watch a few other movies, but the horror section was just popping like in any VHS store from what I remember. So
yep, totally, completely. So then he does Nightmare on Elm Street, and you know, he writes that movie and he gives birth to, like I said in the intro, one of the most famous horror icons in the last 50 years. I mean, the Freddy Krueger, everyone knows who Freddy Krueger is. He becomes an anti-hero. They make toys out of him, for Pete's sakes. I mean, there was a talking Freddy doll. He's on lunch boxes. This is a guy who was the bastard son of 1,000 maniacs, and yet he becomes this almost like lovable icon of movies. It's unreal. But even then, that still doesn't put Craven like in the driver's seat, because he doesn't own Freddy Krueger.
Right.
He gets paid to direct the movie. And anytime you direct a hit movie, that's going to help you in your career, no doubt. But it didn't make him rich. If you ask the average person, hey, do you think the guy who created Freddy Krueger is rich? You'd say, he's got to be, right? He's got Freddy Krueger. Who doesn't know Freddy Krueger? Nope. New Line owned it. And that's why they did, you know, 17 Freddy Krueger movies, but Wes Craven wasn't really involved in any of them until he does New Nightmare.
Right. Yeah. Well, because did he direct Dream Warriors?
No, he didn't. He wrote it, but he only ever did two. He did the first one and then New Nightmare.
Oh, he wrote it. Okay. That's why I remember him working on that. Okay. I was going to say that there's a book that came out from, I believe, Feminist Press. I hope that that's correct, because I don't know off the top of my head, but it's called It Came from the Closet: Queer Reflections on Horror. And they have a piece, I forget who actually wrote it. There's a whole bunch of different writers in this collection, and they're all really good. I recommend this book really highly, but I wanted to mention, because there's something that one of the person who covers Nightmare on Elm Street talks about, which is that there's this whole plot line where he's like a child murderer. Yep. And then this guy, it's like they start talking about how that doesn't actually make sense, because if a whole bunch of children disappeared, then like everybody would know. And I found out that he was actually supposed to be like a child predator, right? Like he was like a sketchball who was like, oh, like, you know, that's basically the idea behind the script. And they changed it. Hmm. And it, so that it could, I believe that it had something to do with like ratings, and they were just kind of like, let's change this part. Like, we don't want to go there in this movie, but it means that the film has this kind of message that's about the abuse that exists in suburban environments, in like religious institutions, you know, like in, you know, any number of places where people kind of don't, it's like a secret, like, you know, but so they kill Freddie, and it's basically supposed to be about this, right? Like, it's basically because that the all of the kids are still alive, but everybody's just pretending that they forgot it and it never happened, which wouldn't necessarily be the case if like they had actually, like, if he had murdered a bunch,
right, if they're dead, right? Yeah
so like that, it's an interesting thing, because I was like, wow, that really does change the whole context. And because I've seen all of the sequels, I know that that vibe is very much with him, right? Like, it's by the time you get to oh God, Freddy's dead. Like, it's pretty explicit, right? Like, they kind of cover that he was like, you know, a different kind of a monster, I guess, than just a murderer, and with quotations and just, right? But it's just it was like a really fascinating article for me, because I was just like, oh, you're right. That didn't make sense. Like, oh my God. And then you kind of are like, oh, that makes it be even weirder that he's such this kind of pop cultural icon. And then what's Heather, her last name,
the Langenkamp?
Langenkamp,
yeah, I believe, correct? So yep, I believe so.
Heather Langenkamp does a documentary where she's like, why does everybody love this guy more actually than Nancy, who's like the main character of the
right
movie,
yeah
and is like the protagonist, and talks to a bunch of people in this documentary about that stuff too, like, or it might have just been like a lengthy doc video. I don't quite remember exactly what the format was, but I remember watching clips of that pretty recently too, where I was just like, that is a good question, because I don't think that Wes Craven was like, Freddy's gonna take off, right? Like,
no, right, yeah, like, he's meant to be repulsive, he's meant to be the villain, he's not gonna
have action figures, yeah, right? Like, but he does, and he became a huge character, to the point where, you know, it was Beatles mania with this guy. Like, Freddy mania. And you know, it's had such an interesting impact, though, because it's, you know, no matter how you look at it, it really is about this idea that everything is, your neighborhood is beautiful, your parents have jobs, they're respected members of the community, you go to a pretty nice high school, you know, you have friends, you have your future, there's like all of these things, but underneath it all, there was a serial abuser who lived in your community that was like literally like torched one day, because the methods of getting justice for those crimes was basically like non-existent, right? So just a wild, wild movie for me in that regard. And then I also think too that it's kind of, you know, it has so many different capacities. People love that franchise, and I love that franchise. It's great. You know, like, it's a really disturbing series of films, and some more than others. Like, some are like kind of rough, or it's all just cartoon stuff, but even those I can find to be fun, I guess. So yeah
I mean, he's squaring off versus Jason, for Pete's sakes. I mean, he's been elevated to Godzilla versus Megalon status.
I watched that movie at like 5 o'clock in the morning, I think, at like the Music Box of Horrors, which is a 24-hour horror marathon that they do in Chicago at the Music Box Theater. And I loved it then because I was so like kind of sleep delirious that like I hadn't slept, and I was like, and I had done like a bunch of driving to get there and like all kinds of stuff. And it was just 5 o'clock in the mornings, and I had been drinking beers slowly for hours. And so I was just like, this movie is funny, at least I'll give it that.
So I mean, that helps, you know, cement his career. But again, it's still not, I mean, if you look at his IMDb, you would think, okay, man, he just directed one of the most iconic horror movies of the 80s, right? So that means it's all smooth sailing from here on. Well, his next thing is another TV movie called Chiller, which is okay. And then he does an episode of The Magical World of Disney, unbelievably, right? So it's like, and then he does Deadly Friend, which is, you know, again, people love just putting the word deadly in front of any movie with Wes Craven.
Yeah.
And that's another movie that when he, it's about robot Christy Swanson, let's say it, it's robot Christy Swanson.
Yep.
And he envisioned it as this sort of sci-fi treatise on, you know, humanity. And as I said earlier, it's like, that's what they hired him to do. And then the studio screens it and they're like, yeah, but it's not Wes Craven-y enough. Go back and shoot a bunch of kills. And it turns it into a more traditional. And it's like, you would think a guy that just directed Nightmare on Elm Street would have a little more heft to be able to say, no, we're not doing that. But no, still not. So it's like, I feel so bad for this guy, because it's like, why does Hollywood keep kicking him around when he's clearly like a very renowned, like he's a guy that's implanting ideas into the popular consciousness that are with us to this day. And yet Hollywood is still like, no, let's have something where Christy Swanson throws a basketball and somebody's head explodes. You know, like,
which, like, you know, I don't want to say that, I don't know, I'm pro Wes Craven and probably against, I would generally consider myself to be against the studio heads interfering, but I will say that basketball and head exploding situation is pretty tight.
But that, well, see, that's the other thing though, is that I watched Deadly Friend, and it's not a great movie. No. And it makes me think, well, okay, yeah, the horror, you can almost tell when the horror scenes are like crowbarred into the movie. You can see it. And it's like, well, but that's also the most memorable part. Are those scenes, were they that wrong? Was it, you know what I mean? I don't know. I don't know, you know, but I'm thinking about how, like, you mentioned Toby Hooper and like John Carpenter, and it's like, you know, Carpenter had a bunch of flops. I mean, but he was able to have some level of creative. The Thing was a flop, but he was able to retain creative control over his films up until a certain point. But Craven just didn't seem, it still took him a while to have all that, which just seems so unfair considering how successfully, I mean, again, you would think just for Freddy Krueger alone, but you know, that's not how Hollywood works. But that said, it seems like right after that, I have to wonder if the younger audiences started catching up, because then he's doing Serpent in the Rainbow, which is terrific, and then Shocker and People Under the Stairs. And those are all Wes Craven's .. Like, at that point, he's becoming somewhat of a brand. And those are all original films. You know, they're not existing IP or, I mean, Serpent in the Rainbow was a book, but it's, those are all original concepts that he's bringing forth. And then, of course, then he does New Nightmare, where he's in it. He's in it as himself.
Yeah. Now,
I have not seen that movie since I saw it in the theater. I don't remember liking it a whole lot, but I know you like it a lot, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's one of my favorites. I love that movie, actually. That's a really fun one. I think in a lot of ways, I view it as being this kind of precursor to Scream, because there's so much meta commentary in it.
Sure.
And there's a lot of humor, and there's a lot of, you know, people playing themselves, people kind of making like these Easter egg references. This is the stuff that I think is really fun in blockbuster horror, because it does kind of combine that. A lot of blockbuster film franchises do stuff like that, so I always think it's kind of fun. Also, I will note, I love Freddy's Dead. He's not the person that directed that. Rachel, what's the last name?
I forget the name of the, I saw that movie in the theater. I had my 3D glasses and everything. Oh, Lord.
I love it. Like, that movie is so good, because it's not really a horror movie so much as it's like a ode to the 90s in a weird way. It's just like, look, we're going to have Freddy in a video game. We're going to have Freddy, you know, it's so weird, but I watched it as a kid again, and I loved it so much. I've always loved that movie. I still love it. I think it's really funny, but I think it's interesting because I do believe that there was groundwork, right? Like, New Nightmare doesn't come out of nowhere, I guess is what I want to say. And Freddy's Dead was like very much panned, right? And then New Nightmare, I think, has like a slightly kinder viewing for a lot of fans. And I don't think that's necessarily fair because they're both kind of doing similar things. I like both of them a lot. But I will say too that New Nightmare is fun because the meta commentary, the characterization, I love the dialogue. Like there's Wes Craven writing dialogue is always great. I don't know if he wrote this movie, but he's a, I think, an underplayed dialogue writer. And he's also worked with some of the best dialogue writers in horror, like over his career. So that's something I always look out for the dialogue in these films because it's often what kind of keeps me engaged. But it was nice to have a movie that commented on how Freddy becomes a cartoon character and then how scary he still is and how that's not, it doesn't really matter. You know, we can make light of things as much as we want, but this is still a guy who has like knife hands. He's still the guy that like viscerally murdered Tina in that first film, right? So it's in one of the most disturbing scenes to this day. Like it's so upsetting, right?
He
So
turned people into pizza toppings and
like, I
ate
mean,
their heads like sausage. Yeah.
this guy is wild. So yeah, I love the movie for that reason. I think that Heather, I keep almost saying Lagomorph because I live with Lagomorphs. I live with rabbits, right? So I keep being like Heather Lagomorph. That is not her last name, but she's really good in that movie too. I think she does a great performance and is able to really tap into the humor and the horror of the moment. So.
I'll have to give it another try. I only saw it the one time in the theater, and I remember just being like, I don't know. But that was also 25 years ago. You know what I
Oh
mean?
yeah.
So
And
I'll give it another try.
same here. I was a kid when I saw it who already had a very good working knowledge of all of the Freddy movies in a way that was like overall positive. Like I'm not one of the people who was like these sequels are stupid because I was just like, "Oh, another Freddy movie. That's great." And like maybe I like this one less than the others or something, but I was always just down to watch a Freddy movie. So
Right. You know what you're going to get at a certain point.
I kind of knew what I was getting into, I guess I'll say.
He's going to make a little quip. He's going to, welcome to Wonderland, Ellis. There's going to be a lot of that. You know what you're going to get, and that's okay. So then he does Vampire in Brooklyn with Eddie Murphy, which, have you seen that?
I've seen it a few
That
times,
is
actually.
really, I had a tough time getting through it because to me, it's not funny and it's not scary. So it's like, well, what is it then? It's not. And I mean, I don't mean to limit Eddie Murphy or anybody, but to me, it's like if you have Eddie Murphy in your movie and he's not being funny on purpose, I don't why. Why? He's one of the funniest people to ever walk the planet, and
I
he's the
get
straight man in the movie. I don't
he
know.
is. I think maybe he was just dying to do something different. But I mean, Angela Bassett's in this and she's really good. But I also think that it's kind of a, I watched it with my friend Monica a couple of years ago and we were both just like, yeah, this isn't like a very good movie, but I love it so much, kind of in this weird way. Like I got a lot of enjoyment out of watching it and was just like, this is just Dracula. I mean, that's all it is, right?
Yeah, I had to
It's
watch
like
it in
is
parts.
a Dracula with a few like kind of bad jokes and all of this kind of extra stuff added in. But it's to me, it was fun. I liked it. But once again, this is something I watched when I was like 12 or something. Like, yeah, 1995, I was 12. So that's when I first saw it. So I think maybe I just had like an overall friendly view of pretty much most horror movies I
There you
watched at the
go.
time.
So then he does Scream. Then he does Scream, and boom! I mean, Scream. Good Lord, they just did one a month ago at the franchise, and it was like a huge hit too. I mean, it's rocking and rolling, and it makes me think that's like I can't think of another. I don't. Again, I keep. I don't even mean to call him a horror director because it's like probably the he's a director, but I can't think of other directors of his class in terms of genre and age that have gotten the opportunity to have their work put in front of a new generation. Like John Carpenter hasn't really had that chance, or Tobe Hooper. Like none of them got to do a movie that younger people got was for them and got to embrace. So Wes Craven has this whole like second or maybe even can say third act in his career, which is so unusual because now at the, he's like in his 50s and he's directed one of the single biggest hit of his career and something that's like hip. You know, it's like the hip thing. And like, that's just almost unheard of for guys of his class. So it's like, that's fantastic that he was sort of knocking around for so long. And then boom, he's the helmer of this huge thing.
Yeah, the Scream movies are just fascinating, honestly. I love all of them a lot, actually. And it's not because I want to, you know, like, I don't want to be the person who's like, actually, Scream 3 is pretty great. Like, I don't want to be that person in the room, usually, because people, I think that, like, you know, a lot of times people will be like, that's a bad movie because it's a sequel, it went into a weird direction, you know, like that kind of stuff. Which is often true, but Scream 3 has like such good kill scenes. Like it goes to a world of like art almost. And that's kind of what Scream does a lot. Like I think a lot because we've seen, you know, When a Stranger Calls, which is the film where Carol Kane is terrorized as a teenage babysitter who's left alone with the
great movie, kid. Great movie.
You know what? It is. And it kind of goes off the rails, but in a way that I think is good. At first, whenever I watched it again as an adult, I was just like, it goes off and follows the killer for a long time.
It takes a hard right turn, that movie.
And you're just like, who is this guy? Like, why aren't we just dealing? I just, you know, Carol Kane was on the screen for 2 seconds. I want to get back to Carol Kane. Thank you. Like, that's basically what you think, like, the whole movie. Eventually it does, right? And then the sequel, like I said, there's an underrated sequel that you can hunt down for that. But it's a fascinating movie, but it's based obviously on, you know, real life stories of like the babysitter who's killed when she is babysitting these kids. And there's so many takes on this story at this point. It's not just an urban legend, it's based in reality. And it's one of those things that is so terrifying, like this teen girl who's getting these phone calls. And then of course the person who's calling her is like right there, is like right inside the house. That's mortifying. And she keeps thinking, you know, locking the doors, like thinking that by putting a barrier up, like she's going to be able to protect herself, which is normally what the right thing to do would be. And in this case, it's the absolute wrong thing to do, right? So there's just something very scary about that. Scream opens on that same riff, pretty much. Yep. You have the character Casey Becker, who's played by Drew Barrymore. And Drew Barrymore is like absolutely killer in it, absolutely charming, funny, like all of the best parts of her. Whenever she's in a movie like Never Been Kissed or Ever After, she brings it to this. And you don't, knowing everything that we know about the horror genre, this is a character that normally would go on to be the main character. And
right, because she was a big movie star at the time. Like she was headlining movie star.
She was the biggest
star.
Person in the movie, probably.
She's on the poster, you know, like she's prominently on the poster.
She is brutally eviscerated in one of the most devastating kill scenes I've ever seen. And to this day, every time I watch that movie, I'm stunned again by how upsetting that opening sequence is, because very much the movie is, you see this trajectory where people can't confront it, you know, because it's like it becomes, you know, this story, the Woodsboro murders becomes the sequel, like the series of films in universe, right? Like the Stab series is right, based right. on, you know, Sidney Prescott's life. And it starts, that movie starts with, you know, Heather Graham in a sexy shower scene playing this Casey Becker character. And she's killed in a way that's like very sexualized. And, you know, in the movie theater in Scream 2, they're all cheering when she dies. And there's just something very fascinating about how much Scream tells you about how much people don't care about victims, right? And like people who end up being kind of the collateral damage, because you have a character like Ghostface, who even in universe becomes this major character. People dress up as Ghostface. Nobody dresses up like Casey Becker, you know, for right, Halloween. Right. And so you have this kind of, to me, a very fascinating premise that's kind of just built in, that's constantly showing how when you go through something traumatic, the world really does just kind of throw it back in your face, like all of the time. And I just think that that's kind of this underbelly of that movie. It's like I think all of his movies have this thing of just like, nope, I'm just doing a slasher. Don't ask too many questions. And then you look at it for a little bit longer and you're just like, this isn't just a slasher. This is like 15 things in one movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Scream is a classically arranged slasher, and as well as like a, you know, Scooby-Doo style whodunit, because at the end, you know, the mask comes off and I tell you my wicked plan and I would have gotten away with it.
Right. You know, yeah. I would have gotten away with it. Yeah.
Sydney Prescott and her meddling friends. So it's like very Scooby-Doo. It's like that. But then there is, as the kill scenes are always devastating. There's, I've almost never do they introduce a character that you're just like, I hope this character dies. Like, it's rare. It does happen, but it's rare. Mostly what you see is characters that you really want to live. Like, I would love for Casey Becker to make it through that first opening sequence because I am really haunted by that sequence, but she can't, right? Like, that's something that it makes the whole movie that she doesn't. And it tells us the what the field of operation is. Like, this is where we're at, this is what we're doing, this can happen in this movie and it will happen again and again and again, mostly to characters you really like Sydney's best friend Tatum gets killed and I love that character in Scream 2. You know, the opening sequence is that couple, like one played by Omar Epps and the other played by Jada Pinkett Smith, and those characters are really likable and they both get killed just absolutely brutally, and then that becomes the thing that Scream does. It always opens with this devastating kill of people that usually we like a lot. So until the fifth movie, and then Jenny Ortega just a lot of people die in the openings of Scream and it's always just hard to watch, but that's not the only one, you know. It's like what is it, Sarah Michelle Gellar's character in the second one, she's really funny and smart through the entire movie and, you know, she still just gets brutally murdered for no reason other than she lives near Sydney Prescott, right? Like, that's it. And it's just like, man, it's not fair, and there's something so brutal to it. And then the movie, the way that the movie and like the way that the media sensation around Sydney won't ever let her forget it is like just a very interesting thing. Like, she has to live inside of this horror movie forever. Like, there's no getting out of it because killers keep coming back. It's like in the second movie, you see her be like, I could move on from this and become a normal person, live a normal life. But by the end of that movie, that's kind of just a foregone conclusion, right?
Right.
It's like, well, she's gonna always be dealing with this now because like everybody wants to talk to her and kind of exploit her story in this way that, you know, it calls back to what life is. Like, we're just talking about how Freddy Krueger is so famous, but then you look at stuff like, you know, Ted Bundy, who's just this like basic dude who sucked really bad, and everybody to this day is like, they remember him, you know, and like they don't always remember the people that he hurt, or
right,
like, yeah, they'll romanticize him and not think about what he did in that like Florida house where he just, you know, bludgeoned like all of these women to death with like a log. Like, you know, it's like we have this way of glorifying that, and I think that Scream is not just a, you know, cheeky fun poke at the horror genre, not just a slasher film, not just a Scooby-Doo whodunit, you know, not just a Final Girl narrative, but it's also something that never forgets how kind of cruel we are, I guess, like, and how the killer is the person who we focus on, you know.
Absolutely. And those themes are in Scream 4, which we will get to, everybody. Yeah, yeah. I promise. We will get to Scream 4.
Oh, man. We got a lot to work through, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many interesting movies. So anyway, so he does Scream 1, huge hit. He does Scream 2, another huge hit. And then the Miramax, wow. Miramax boys, Bob Weinstein and Harvey Weinstein, who, yeah, okay. They were so happy with Craven that they allowed Craven to direct a non-horror movie, and it's really his own. I mean, outside of Red Eye, which is more of a thriller than a horror movie, he does Music of the Heart, this film about a violin studies class in New York, and it was originally supposed to star Madonna, and she and Craven apparently disagreed about the aspects of her character, so she drops out, and with like less than a month to start, they get Meryl Streep, which is unreal. Yeah. And
can you imagine
that? And it makes me think that Wes Craven has got to be the only person ever to direct a porno and Meryl Streep. Like, I mean, nobody else is going to have that, those two things on their filmography. Now, I watch Music of the Heart. It's fine. It's fine. Yeah. I don't think it's anything more than that. It's a nice movie. You know where it's going. It's based on a true story. The performances are great. I mean, of course, Meryl Streep. I mean, that seems kind of de rigueur to say that.
Right.
Great. Angela Bassett's in it again. So obviously, yep. You got along with her after Vampire Brooklyn. It's a perfectly fine movie. I don't think it's anything great, but it was, I just got a kick of seeing his name on something so different than everything else in his filmography.
Yeah, I've actually never seen that one. I remember it being kind of like a white savior sort of deal, right? Is like
it is a little
really,
bit
really nice white person helping everybody. It is based on a true story. There's things about it. I mean, it's a Wes Craven movie, so I'm sure I'll get around to it at a certain point. But it is definitely like, I guess I'll say I'm a bigger Wes Craven fan than I am a Meryl Streep fan. Not, once again, nothing against Meryl Streep. Obviously, we all know what a great actor Meryl Streep is. I don't have to come to bat for Meryl Streep, right? But if I'm going to watch a movie, 9 times out of 10, I'm probably going to watch a horror movie as opposed to, like, you know, a film, any of the great films that Meryl Streep has been in, because she's been in stuff that, you know, I absolutely love. But it is stuff more, you know, Postcards from the Edge is something I usually watch like one time or something, right?
right.
Which, like, it could probably be watched again. I mean, I don't know, but it's just my personal temperament. I'm just more of a horror person, I guess. So
yeah,
I haven't gotten into that one yet, but we'll see.
It was fine. It's very, you feel churlish about saying anything negative about it because it's just such a nice movie.
Yeah.
And it's about, you know, highbrow kind of stuff. You're just like, oh, there should be more movies like this. Is it that memorable? Can I see any sort of Wes Craven he touches? And I don't mean obviously on the kind of basics of, like, yeah, nobody gets murdered in the movie. Obviously, there's no scares in it, but it's perfectly fine. And it's the kind of thing where, okay, you know, I mean, it was reasonably successful. And again, Streep got an Oscar nomination out of it. You know, he could have going on to do other things like this, but it was, you know, I would say good on Miramax for saying, hey man, you're making us a ton of money with these Scream movies.
Yeah.
Here, go do this. You know, we're going to bankroll this.
And he's getting very much like, you know, we didn't know in the moment, but he's getting very much to the end of his career.
Here. Right.
Like,
right. Well, has, right. Exactly.
You know, we've gone through so many films so far and he's got what, like 6 after this and, five, but you know, just not that many movies to go. And so it's just, it's kind of a fascinating thing. Cause it's like, I'm like, I don't know what he thinks about Music of the Heart, but I am just like, does it feel good? Did it feel good to finally like direct something that's got like Oscar nominations and stuff?
Yeah, nobody gets stabbed in it, you know? So great. Awesome. So then he does Scream 3, again, another hit. He does Cursed, which was kind of a
werewolves.
Werewolves, but it was a quite teenage, literally a cursed production in that, like, it was shot over the course of 2 years and they're like entire characters taken out of the movie. And then the movie was rewritten to feature Jesse Eisenberg. And it was originally about three people. It was about Christina Ricci, Jesse Eisenberg, and Skeet Ulrich. And then Skeet Ulrich is completely edited out of the movie. It was just a complete mess. The studio apparently just kept futzing with and Craven regretted doing, because he said it ended up eating up 2 years of my life when it was supposed to be kind of like this quickie project. And he said in the book, I could have gotten more films done had I not had to spend 2 years reshooting and reshooting and like, to tell you how bad Cursed potentially is. I mean, I don't think it was that bad, but like Robert Forster was supposed to be in the movie and he's cut out of the entire movie. Like, what? You don't cut Robert Forster out of your movie.
What are you doing?
That's never a good idea.
Yeah. And so it's with the team of Kevin Williamson and Wes Craven, who are the people who brought us, you know, the Scream films. So it is very interesting that, like, they kind of tried to go into this. I remember thinking it was fine. I mean, I don't know. This time period is rough for werewolf graphics, right? Like, CGI werewolves are like,
pretty cartoony.
They're rough. Pretty cartoony. Yeah, but, you know, I mean, people struggle with werewolves, I think, even in practical effects or anything. I just think it's hard to get a good werewolf going. But Yeah, I don't know. That's what I remember. I could be wrong. I might be slandering this movie. I remember watching it though, because it was a horror movie. Wes Craven and Christina Ricci was in it. So, werewolves, I'm sold.
It is dated a bit in that Christina Ricci, her job in the movie, she's a booker for the Craig Kilborn show, which is, Craig Kilborn makes a dramatic appearance in it. So yeah, pretty rough. So then he does Red Eye with Cillian Murphy and Rachel McAdams, which I actually thought was pretty good.
It's all right. He's really scary. She is good at playing the tension of the scene. I have like a weird confession to make, which is that literally I saw this movie in the theaters, and ever since, like, I've always thought that it was Jennifer Garner in this movie. And whenever I was watching it, I still thought it was Jennifer Garner. And then I like looked it up and it was like Rachel McAdams. And I was like, this is a completely different person than Jennifer Garner. So apparently I just think that those, like, Rachel McAdams and Jennifer Garner are completely interchangeable. I don't know if that's true. I'm sure that they both have very unique interests apart from one another.
Both perfectly nice women. Yes, I'm sure. Yeah.
They seem both really nice and everything, but yeah, it just like kind of cracked me up because I was like, no, for sure. I'm like not looking at Jennifer Garner right now. For some reason, I thought it was her. But I'm going to say that now that I know that it was Rachel McAdams, I got to say she did a pretty great job. Cillian Murphy plays a complete, you know, bastard, basically. And he's great at it, as we know. You know, anybody who's seen pretty much anything has probably seen Peaky Blinders, where he plays somebody who gets real violent in a way where he keeps like a unfazed expression. And this guy is good at that too. So
he played the Scarecrow, one of my favorite Batman villains in the Dark Knight movie. So
I love that villain too.
Yeah. One other thing I will say about Red Eye that I appreciate about Wes Craven's filmography, just from the context of being a podcaster and watching his movies for the show, all his movies are like 90 minutes. He did not deliver 2 hour and 10 minute cuts. Like Red Eye is like 84 minutes. I'm like, yeah, God bless you, Wes Craven.
Yeah, we're going through your whole discography. That makes it really easy on us. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. None of this thing where it's like, oh, it's 147. Like, come on.
And there's nothing repetitive. That's the thing too, is like he touches on these similar themes, which I think is like, to your point, it makes sense that people are like, oh, he had a strict Baptist upbringing and then he became wacky horror guy. I think that is like interesting, kind of, that there's no repeats. Like it's not, you know, other than maybe The Hills Have Eyes too, he's not really like repeating himself. Like the Scream sequels all very much stand apart from one another. You have something like Cursed, which is nothing like anything that he's done before. Vampire in Brooklyn, nothing like anything he's done before. People Under the Stairs, Serpent in the Rainbow, Shocker. These are all movies that stand very much on their own. If anybody had just come in and done any one of these movies, you know, it's like, it would make sense, because it's like he's not phoning it in. That's the he's just kind of here with us.
Yeah, like it's a lot of original concepts, a lot of original ideas, you know. So then he did a segment for the omnibus film Paris Je T'aime, which is this little comedy segment with about Oscar Wilde, which was cute.
Right.
But then he's got a ghost in it. Even then, you know, there's some supernatural element to it. Then he did My Soul to Take. Now that one I have not seen. That's his penultimate film. Now you've seen that, right? Is that any good?
I watched it today. It is actually not very good, but, you know, what are you going to do? It almost feels like it makes sense for that. I believe it's like the last one where he was involved in all of the creative process. He did like the writing, he did the, you know, everything. So I think that was the last one of that kind. And he wrote it, so it does sound like almost a greatest hits compilation. Like he just kind of smashes a whole bunch of the things that he had done in the past and kind of hits like fast forward. So it's like very like fast and, it really doesn't work, but it's one of those ones where you're like, well, I'm glad you got at least one last thing that is, if nothing else, a very Wes Craven movie. Like I will say, I gotta say, it's probably one of my least favorites of his. It just kind of doesn't hold up, but not for lack of trying. I think that there's something there and it didn't work, but you know, he's getting, you know, he would be no longer with us in like a year after the film was released, right? or two years.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. So then he does Scream 4, which, as I said at the top of the show, I did not even know existed. I didn't even know there was a film. It came out on April 15th, 2011. So I'm going to do a very brief plot synopsis for Scream 4. Spoilers, everybody, yes, in case you haven't seen it. So on the 15th anniversary of the Woodsboro murders, two young girls are killed by Ghostface using the same tactics seen in the previous films. Soon after, Sydney Prescott returns to Woodsboro to promote her self-help book about surviving trauma. Unfortunately, the book signing she is there for is ruined when evidence of the murders ends up in her car, forcing her to stay in town during the investigation. Ghostface's threatening calls continue, and Dewey Riley, now the sheriff, tries to find out who is the culprit. Meanwhile, his wife Gail Weathers decides to investigate the murders against her husband's wishes. Gail teams up with two teenage horror fanatics who have concluded that Ghostface is committing these murders in the same traditions as horror movie remakes. They bet that Ghostface will try and strike next at Stabathon, a movie marathon featuring all seven of the Stab films. Ghostface attacks Gail, then kills more of the town's teens at an after party. Sydney arrives, and it's revealed that there are two Ghostfaces, Charlie and Jill, who are working together. Jill tells Sydney she's jealous of the attention Sydney has gotten from surviving the attacks and intends to frame someone else for the murders and pretend to be the survivor herself. Sydney is stabbed and gets taken to the hospital, where Jill follows her and tries to kill her. Dewey realizes Jill is the killer, but she pulls a gun on him and Gail. Sydney manages to grab the gun and shoot Jill dead. As Dewey calls in reinforcements, reporters begin to describe Jill as the sole surviving victim of Ghostface. Nev Campbell, of course, returns as Sydney. David Arquette as Dewey. Courtney Cox as Gail. Emma Roberts is Jill. Hayden Panettiere is Kirby. Rory Culkin is Charlie. And it was once again written by Kevin Williamson. So I watched this movie for the first time. I loved the opening. The film within a film within
the
a film.
The opening is, oh my God, that is like that's the ultimate Scream joke right there, right? Like, that's like the joke of the franchise. I don't know that they'll ever do a better joke than that, because
when it goes
just
to
like
the third level, and we're now with Kristen Bell and Anna Paquin, I really started to say, how many levels are we going to go?
And then he's being like, Scream, or no, sorry, Stab 6, Stab 7.
Yeah. And I really got excited. Now, I will say, I think after that, the movie kind of drops down to a lower register, and it sort of stays there. And I'm kind of curious what you thought, because I'm nothing against Nev Campbell at all. But, and like you said earlier, like, she is the face of the franchise, and she deserves every dollar she can get, you know, to be in these movies. But I feel like I felt like in this one, she feels like she's kind of bored. I don't know. Am I right? She just feels like she's like just a little tired of doing all this.
They don't, I think that they kind of like lose vision with her a little bit, mm-hmm, as a character, because at a certain point, she's just the one who keeps not dying, right? Like,
right.
But
yeah.
I will say that I think that there's an interesting commentary in it, right? Like, I felt very much the same way the first time I watched it. The second time I watched it, I felt like there was a lot more nuance in her performance than I was giving her credit for on the first viewing. And this is as somebody who does love Nev Campbell. So even if that nuance isn't there, I'll do it for you, Nev. Like, don't even worry. I'll do my part to make this a great performance.
I'll fill in the gaps for you.
but I do think that I think that there's something there, right? Like, it's an interesting approach to the character, because at this point we saw her, obviously her mom has just been killed a year before whenever we first meet her. She goes through her boyfriend being an absolute sketchball to her and one of their friend group teaming up to murder her. She survives that. She loses like this guy who might have been the love of her life in Scream 2. She's out there doing like theater and stuff. By the third one, she's completely removed from society. She lives in isolation. She works, I believe, at like a trauma or like a crisis care line or something like that, but she doesn't leave her house. Like, she's in the middle of nowhere. She's obviously very privileged. She has like a lot of money, you know, from what I can tell, because she's always able to kind of move around at will. But we don't know. We never hear too much about that. By the time it gets to the fourth one, You know, there's this kind of commentary where she's like, I wrote this book because I want to set the record straight. We never would have seen her in the third film, like the way that she was there, go on to write a book, I feel like. But 10 years have passed. And we have her kind of the commentary around it is, you know, her agent at one point literally says, you're a victim. You might as well make the most of it or something. And she fires this agent, right? And it's like, it's like the thing that I think frustrates me about Scream sometimes is that it really drops these kind of like, it's like sometimes it's like a little wishy-washy on the points that it's making, I guess, but some could call that nuance, you know, choose your own adventure. To me, it feels like a lack of commitment to being like, yeah, we're saying something that's not just like a cheeky rejoinder, right? Like we're saying something that's like real with this character. They say this kind of stuff where at the end, Jill, the person, you know, Emma Roberts, has this, you know, Scooby-Doo monologue, and she says, you know, everybody just wants to see you be traumatized. Like, everybody wants, that's what I'm going to do, is like, I'm going to live through this trauma and then I'm going to become famous for life. And that there, so there is this kind of commentary on how this is what, once you're known for having lived through something horrible, people kind of want there to be this, like, oh, like you're getting by one day at a time, like your bravery and your courage, and like people are not able to see you break down, you know, or something. It's like it's better for them. They want you to be like this strong figure. And I think that that's kind of what they were doing with Sydney in this. There's a scene where Ghostface, and I'm guessing that this one's Jill, because there's like kind of just the way that she approaches it, I think it's Jill who's the Ghostface in this call. But she says, your one and only skill is that you're a survivor, but what good is it to survive if everyone around you is dead? And I just think that that's kind of like the secret theme of the movie in a weird way, because you watch it. I had to watch this movie like three times pretty recently, just because I've been writing about Scream a lot lately. But it was just kind of this thing that finally started to stand out to me more, where I was like, yeah, it gets credit for being about these nerds who are film nerds and evil, right? Because like we had Randy, the good film nerd, right? And these are the evil ones. And I think that there's something kind of interesting about that, and how the social media angle was this huge part of it, and it was kind of, you know, predicted a lot of things that we would see very shortly after the film aired.
Yeah,
You know, at the
seriously.
time, I'm sure people were like, that's ridiculous. And then 5 years later, that's just the world that we live in. And, you know, so I think that there's touches of that to it. But it was something that stood out to me overall, where I was like, I think that what they're saying is that they don't know what to say with Sydney. And like at this point, you know, because what are we doing with her unless she's like surviving these traumas? We really don't find out that much about what else is going on in her life, you know. Like it's so there is this kind of surface level thing. Like we don't ever really get closer to Sydney, right? Like we've seen Sydney again and again and again in these movies. And we love her one-liners, you know, like she's just like a great character that I think a lot of people have a lot of fondness for. And, you know, a lot of people will be like, oh, she's like a great feminist character and things. I think that that's all valid reads. But I also think about how it's hard to get close to people who are survivors of violent things in life, right? Because not like that there's something wrong, but just that there's understandably can be walls up and things, right? And I think that we see the walls come up in Sydney like more and more and more as time goes on. But she still is like reaching out to people in a very interesting way. Like I said, she helps people. She tries to reach out to Jill, you know, in the movie that follows this, the fifth Scream film, she helps the Carpenter sisters, who are now kind of like the main characters of the franchise for the time being. She helps them. She shows up only to help them, basically. She's like, I feel really not safe with this, but I came back because I need to make for sure that we take care of this. And it's interesting because in that she's more of like a hardened, like conservative gun owner. You know, it's just kind of a weird like turn to take with her, but it was the upside of it is you feel like she's really survived a lot.
Like kind of what they
And
did to Laurie Strode in the Halloween, the David Gordon Green Halloween movie.
It's very similar to that. And it's interesting to me because I feel like they do sort of drop these things in where it's like, oh, if you go through so much trauma, you'll become a conservative, essentially, is kind of like the message I've gotten from a lot of the horror film conspiracy theorists, yep. Paranoid all the time, like, don't take my guns away from me kind of stuff. And it's
your
like,
windows are boarded up, you've got barbed wire, you know, just, all this kind of stuff.
It's like, it just doesn't really make sense for these characters that we met. Sure, time changes us, trauma changes us, you know, I understand these things, but I gotta say, like, you meet Sydney, and one of the first lines that she speaks is whenever they find out that Casey has been killed, and they're all making kind of light teenage jokes about it. And she's just like, how do you gut somebody? Like, just absolutely devastated by it. And it's just like, she like can't get over it. And of course that turns into a joke as well. But it's just this idea of this character who's so sensitive that these acts of violence really aren't anything that was... but that's it. Like, you know, there's a scene pretty recently in like the sixth movie where Gail Weathers says, you know, Sydney deserves her happy ending. And that really made me think, because I was like, everybody in these movies other than the serial murderers deserve a happy ending. You know, it's not like Sydney's the only one who deserves that. It's just an interesting thing because it's just like, yeah, I think that they just like, it's like their original commentary was like, this is like the final girl. And then it kind of turned into like, well, what the hell do we say now? And to them, I think then it becomes like, well, now she's a gun owner. And like, I'm just like, oh yeah, like, I just think that's interesting. I just think it's an interesting turn to take with the character. I don't know if I agree with it, honestly, but it speaks to how, you know, it does feel sometimes that they did like a little bit just like lose the willingness to give her much interesting stuff to do. Like, she always says like she doesn't like horror movies, and I'm like, you know what I would like to see is Sydney who likes horror movies. I think that'd be fun, you know, like, let's do something like interesting, you know, like, I her becoming like a conservative isn't that interesting to me, you know, like, there's some stuff and four is interesting to me, but it does also feel like what they were supposed to do was that should be like almost like a hinge, and then like she comes back in a different way later, and it feels like it kind of like loses direction around that time for her. And in the third movie, you know, she's dealing with like weird family stuff. The stuff with her mom is wild, right? Because like in the third one, they go through this whole thing of like, here's all the seedy underbelly of Hollywood that her mom was involved in for 2 years when she vanished from this town or whatever. And it's like, you all have had like a lot of violent crimes happen to Sydney's mom, like in a row kind of, and then she like is murdered, and I'm always like, what's up with that? Like, it's just always interesting. It's interesting how they approach these things, I guess, in this franchise.
I will say something I really did like in Scream 4 is I thought of the younger actors, I really thought Hayden Panettiere was really funny. Like, she really seemed to pop.
Yeah.
Like, she seemed like she had like a good energy too. I think she kind of knew the movie she was in. Cause the problem, I think, a little bit with the Scream films is that the first film is taking the piss out of horror tropes, but then it's by doing multiple sequels, you're kind of, you know, like you're starting to like circle the drain a little, cause you're like referring to yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, well, how many ways can we keep doing this before it becomes absurd? And there's inherently a comedic tilt to it, despite all the bloody horror. And the kills are pretty gruesome still. Again, for Wes Craven, a guy like in his 60s at that point, he's still not lighting up on that. You know, the opening scene of Lucy Hale getting killed, and yeah, that's all pretty rough. But Hayden Panettiere, I actually thought, like, was just, to me, every time she was on screen, I was like, oh, she's kind of livening this up a little.
Yeah.
And then she gets dispatched about halfway through the film. I'm like, oh. Okay, but I was like, oh, I like her. Now, does she come back? I didn't see the fifth one.
She came back in 6 as a cop, and it's like, what is that? Like,
okay, right.
I heard that she was back.
I was like, wait, yeah, okay.
That's the thing. Like, Scream has such inconsistent commentary on cops, because it's always just like, yeah, they're totally useless, but like, then Dewey is such a main character for such a long time, and you're just like, In fours, Dewey is like a borderline villain, like honestly, because he really in it, it's like in the same way that we see cops do in real life, his pride inhibits the capture of this murderer. And
yeah, he's pretty
you know,
inept.
by the,
yeah.
He and he's so dismissive to Gail, it's really gross. And Gail is the one, Gail's the MVP of that franchise, like from pretty much the beginning, even though she can be kind of a dick, like she still is the best because you know, she's the one who cracks the case. She's the one who has, she doesn't like discover exactly who did it, but she's the one who is like, okay, we're like, now you can get them. You know, like I did all of this investigative research and now you can get them. Go. I've been stabbed 5 times, so I'm out too. But, and then it's like, that's the same thing. She just keeps coming back in these really cool ways. But, you know, it's just interesting to me that they don't, yeah, they never, the cops end up just dying all of the time and being like kind of useless. And then they're just like, oh, but here's Kirby as a cop. And then she's like a rogue cop who got like let go because she drinks too much or something. And I'm like,
okay,
what? I never would have seen, I don't think that that scans from the character that we met, right? Like, cause I just think that she, if anything, like she's making her own movies now or something. Like that's how it felt to me. So I was like, this is a weird turn to take with that character too. But
it's interesting to now, of course, he said this is, I don't, you know, I'm sure Craven did not intend this to be his final film. He passed away a couple of years later, and you know, still a relatively young man. And it's interesting to think, I mean, it's not entirely unique. But it's still pretty rare to have one director direct this many installments of a franchise. I mean, like, yeah, you know, Spielberg did the 4 Indiana Jones movies. Michael Bay did, I think, like the first 4 Transformers films, but it's pretty unique. Generally, directors don't stay with a franchise, but here's Craven doing all 4. And it would have been interesting to see if they had decided to, when they decided to reboot the Scream franchise for 5, whether they would have, had he been around, they would have tapped him to do it. You know, I mean, would he still be working today?
It was Kevin Williamson, like the screenwriter. So, you know, it feels like they would still be doing this franchise. And that's fine with me. You know, like, I think that Scream 4 is really good. It's an interesting movie because I can see, first of all, whenever it came out, people were like, what? Who cares? Like, this movie sucks or whatever.
Just putting 4 at the end of your movie is hard. Just inherently. You're like, 4? The fourth of this thing?
Yeah. I think it got kind of undersold in a way, and I do think that it's a really good one. It is one that's a little bit like that's it, the flow that Wes Craven always has with his actors, like it's just not totally there with this one. You know, like I think even in 3 there was great flow with Sydney. Like I think that, you know, he's even in, you know, we just talked about Sharon Stone, you know, we've talked about actually a lot of the really good performances that he gets from his actors. And it feels like in 4, the flow is less there than ever because he kind of has these characters that are so off-putting that you're like, of course there's something off about this character.
Right.
He's very off-putting, right? And like he uses that actually to pretty good effect because like the boyfriend's very off-putting too, but the boyfriend gets killed like really fast. So, you know, I just think it is a kind of a wild one to go out on. The Scream franchise is continuing and I find that it has continued to be pretty solid blockbuster horror stock. It has great self-references, Easter eggs, all of that stuff that, you know, I think is really fun, but I love this movie in a way that it's like you love it even though there are flaws. It like doesn't totally work. Like there's a bunch of things that don't, you know, like I said, that first Scream movie, the flow is unstoppable. Like the whole time you're watching it, all thriller, no filler. Like that's how all of those films go. And then it's like you get to this one and it's like that rapport with the actors doesn't seem to always be there. There's absolute exceptions because as you said, the actor that plays Kirby, she's incredible. and really does steal the scenes. Emma Roberts is, of course, just like, if you give Emma Roberts a speech where she's like talking about how horrible she is.
Oh yeah, she's great at playing just an absolutely monstrous person. Yeah,
the supervillain monologue will never recover after it loses Emma Roberts. I hope that she's doing this for years and years to come, because every time she does it, you're just like, bravo, bravo, like this is good. You know, you kind of are tapping into like the Roberts legacy in a way. Like it's very interesting to watch her work, but she's great in Scream 4. There's a lot of people who are great in Scream 4. I think that Neve Campbell's great in Scream 4, but it's interesting because the way that you say she seems kind of bored, kind of over it. And then it's like, when I watch it back, I'm just like, yeah, they're giving her like almost identical dialogue to what we've seen before and stuff like that in many places. So I can see if as an actor, she is bored by this at this point. But then it's also like, I see somebody who's like also being kind of forced into this role of the strong survivor. And I always think that that's interesting. I wish that they would have the patience to go into it further, because that's kind of what I want to see, is the toll that it takes on people to be put into that position, right? Like, you know, to be the person who was in a true crime story and everybody wants to talk to you about it, but they don't really care, you know, about you or the people that were lost. Like, they just want to hear you tell them a scandalous story, right?
Right.
So
yeah.
I think that there's something to it that's, it feels elusive, like every time I've seen it, where I'm just like, it's hard to grab onto. But once I did, I was like, you know, I think that this is almost the only way that you could follow up Scream 3, because that just goes off the rails at the end, where they're like, woo, we're just going off the rails, everybody. And you're just like, oh, in some fun ways, like I love Scream 3 too. Even though the ending is like thumbs down, not a great ending, but you know, the rest of the movie is good. But I do think that there's something, you know, to Scream 4 that reminds me of Wes Craven's whole damn career, actually, where you're like, there's just something to it. You know, even whenever I'm watching like something kind of silly, like Deadly Blessing, you know, it's silly, but there's like kind of a depth to it that, you know,
I'm never bored. I was never bored watching any of his movies.
Yeah,
not one. Yeah,
not a single one. It compels me. It was one of those things where I was like, you know, I'll think that it's not for me, and then I'm just like, you got me again. Got me again, Wes Craven. I'm like, I'm totally glued to the screen. I can't look away.
That is a perfect place to end it. I can't think of a better compliment you can make to a filmmaker than that, because I've seen a lot of boring movies, but I watched a ton of Wes Craven. Like I said, I was never bored. So. That it will be a great place to wrap up this discussion of Wes Craven. Again, it's just, there's a bunch of great movies worth checking out. If you haven't seen some of the lesser titles, go find them. A bunch of them are on YouTube, and most of them are all available in streaming in one form or the other. And, yeah, there's just a lot of great stuff. He was responsible for a lot of big stuff from my childhood. And so I'm really glad that you pitched this to me, because this would not have been one I necessarily would have thought of, even though I love Wes Craven. And so, it was a real treat to go through his filmography. So thank you so much for doing this, Sarah.
Yeah, of course. See, it's like, if I was going to think, oh, what's one of your all time favorite directors, and what do you want to talk about? It'd be like, oh, let's talk about Agnes Varda, or, you know, Chantal Akerman, or Akira Kurosawa or something. And then, you know, but what I think too is, every time I revisit Wes Craven, I'm like, you're such a better director than honestly, like, you really were ever given credit for. And I don't think all of his movies will be for you, but if you can find the one that you click with, you're going to click with it in a way that I think you'll find really pleasant, right?
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. So again, thank you so much for doing this. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Oh, I wrote a book. I wrote a book of short stories that is called A Small Light and Other Stories by Sarah Century. You can get it from Weird Punk Books. Weird Punk Books is a horror publisher. If you made it this far in this conversation, I'm assuming that you like horror at least a little bit. And you would like Weird Punk if you like Wes Craven. I think there is a lot of stuff that they delve into. They did a anthology actually that was you know, whenever we talked about The Brood on the other podcast.
No, yeah, Film and Water. That was such a fun talk. Talking about David Cronenberg's The Brood. Yeah.
I love that interview. It's really fun. And that is such a good one. But yeah, you know, they did a anthology that was all about, it was like the literary tribute to David Cronenberg, which was what I was also in that. But they published my book of short stories. And it is about isolation. Sometimes birds are in it. It's scary. You know, I don't know. I hope people will check it out. A lot of people have been buying it lately. And if that is you, then thank you for doing so, because it is always nice to support me, small independent horror creators in general. And then, of course, the press Weird Punk. Look around. You'll find something you love. That is, you know, you can follow them anywhere at Weird Punk Books. And I can be found, Sarah Century, pretty much everywhere. You could follow me on Twitter. You can follow me at any of these places. There's a link tree now. I have like a link tree because I run out of air trying to tell people about all of the things that I'm doing sometimes. So I have a link tree on my Twitter or my Instagram or any of the things that any of the social medias that you find me on, and check through that because I know that I forgot something. But also I do the Decoded Horror Channel, which is a narrative horror podcast that's picking up again in May. There's 5 episodes out as of now. If you like scary stories, sounds like you do, then let's, you know, go over there, check out that podcast that I do. And for now, that just has to be it. I'm going to end this just saying that's enough.
All right. Fair enough. So of course you can find all the back episodes of the show on our website, vinewaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to Fade Out on any podcatcher of your choice. If you're so inclined, please go over to Apple Podcasts and leave this show a 5-star review. There are, as any of you know, 40 gajillion movie podcasts. It's very hard to get noticed. And I would really appreciate, we have a lot of the reviews we have for Fade Out are all terrific, but we could always use more. So I would very much appreciate if you could take a couple minutes out and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review for Fade Out. You can find the show on Twitter at Fade Out Pod. And if you want to support Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So we have our first patron sponsor, Monique D. Thank you so much, Monique, for your sponsorship of Fade Out. I really appreciate it. So that's going to do it for this month. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script. So it's time to fade out.
Well, yeah, I have a very sort of ambivalent view of myself as an artist or as a filmmaker. I mean, somebody once, when I was first starting in films in New York, says, if you want something on your gravestone in the film business, I think the best thing is filmmaker. If you can honestly say that, that's all you need to say. And that's, that I think would, I would like that on my gravestone, along with whatever you do, don't fall asleep.